Okay, welcome everybody. This is the office hours session for the Mises Academy Keynes Krugman and the Crisis class. I think it's for lecture 6. And we are opening it up to the students. I think John is typing in a question as we speak. So as usual, for those of you who are logged in live right now, the floor is yours. Just go ahead and post whatever questions you want in the chat box, and I'll tailor my answers accordingly. If there's just a few things there, I'll take a long time. If you give me rapid-fire questions, I'll be briefer. Okay, so John says, make sure I'm not missing anything here. Yep. John says, you say that Keynes, Hicks et al., say that in the situation described above to restore equilibrium, interest rates will rise, especially short-term rates. You add a long explanation of why Keynes thought uncertainty was the reason people hold cash. Makes sense. So how is equilibrium restored, say the Keynesians? Interest rates go up. Well, why would even an Austrian deny that banks would increase interest rates when they're facing lower bank balances on the part of the public, assuming that demand is still greater than the supply of loanable funds? John, can you, where is that coming from? Is that from questions for the professor from week 5? Because I'm not sure what the context is here. Week 5 meaning, or you're saying last week meaning week 5? Okay, hang on, let me, because you're referring to something I wrote, obviously, and I'm not, let me just make sure I'm not misinterpreting. Okay. I was logged in, but it kicked me off. Also, while this is coming up, guys, today I really will, unless I get hit by a bus or something, we'll catch up on all the questions that have accumulated and the questions for the professor. Okay. Oh, well, I guess I wasn't talking in the questions. So, John, when you say I say above, do you mean in the PowerPoint? Is that what you're talking about? In other words, what are you – oh, lecture in week 5. Okay. Let's – I'm also partly doing this just as review. Let me pull that thing up. It'll take a second. And then – we can walk through it because it's partly to refresh my own memory, but also it might help you guys to see me going right through it. So this is summer. So that would be the lecture 5 PowerPoint. Where is that? Okay, so it's just going to take a second for WebEx to bring up the PowerPoint. Still loading. You're talking about the slide C, restoring full employment. So for those who are following along, we're talking about, this is all from week 5. when we're doing the Neo-Keynes and all that stuff, and talking about ISLM. Okay, so after I walk through where those curves come from and how they're based on Keynes's verbal remarks, I said, okay, how do they use it? So I said, all right, so suppose the initial intersection of the IS and LM curves occurs at a point where Y is below the full employment output level, then an increase in government spending or a decrease in the private savings rate can shift the IS curve to the right, and an increase in the quantity of money can shift the LM curve down. And so John is now saying, how is equilibrium restored? Interest rates go up. Well, why would even an Austrian deny that banks would increase interest rates when they're facing lower bank balances on the part of the public? Well, what? Just give me one more piece of information here, John. What do you? I listed the two things the government could do. So, what? The answer is going to be different as to how it expands employment. So, what is the government doing? Are they increasing deficit spending, or are they printing more money? And then I can walk through what I think the Keynesian story is. But the mechanisms are different depending on which thing they do. So can you, what, that's on the next slide. I mean, this is the next, so I'm asking, well, let me just say some stuff, and then if I'm not answering your question, let me know. Okay, so here I'm looking at the ISLM curve that I got from Wikipedia. So here they're showing the LM curve being constant and the IS curve shifts up. So remember, let me get my pointer activated. So here's Y1. So initially what happens is, you know, you got the initial IS curve, IS1, and then the initial LM curve, and they intersect here. So the interest rate is here, and initial Y, which is output, is there. So the point is, there is, you're always at equilibrium in that sense, in the Hicksian framework, the mechanical framework. So incidentally, that should help you guys with one of the test questions this week, if you haven't already done the multiple choice, is that it's in a liquidity trap, it's not the case that you're off the ISLM curves. It's just, no, they're intersecting at this Y1 that is less than full employment. So from looking at this diagram, you don't know where full employment is, but the Keynesians will just say it could be the case that the level of output needed to employ everybody is above this equilibrium Y1 level. All right, so maybe I should just make sure you guys get that. That's the thing with the Keynesians. It's like, they think about stuff in the reverse causality from the way Austrians think about it. So the way I would normally think about it is, you employ a certain amount of people, and the more people you employ, the more stuff that gets produced. Like, that's the cause and effect, that people physically produce stuff. And so if employment goes up, you're cranking out more stuff. And the Keynesians do it the opposite way. They reason in terms of the explanatory variables they use, like total spending and stuff, and figure out, okay, what does equilibrium output have to be? And then they say, how many workers would it take to create that much stuff? And then that's how many workers end up being employed. So, you know, in terms of their causal chain, they go from spending to output to employment. Whereas I kind of think of it as, well, no, the employment produces the output. And so therefore, I think in terms of what are the factors leading to workers being employed or not, and then they produce that much stuff. So it's true, if you ask Paul Krugman point blank, does output create employment or does employment create output? And we mean in terms of the laws of physics and engineering, I mean, yeah, he's going to understand that it's not that a TV creates a job, it's that a worker with a job physically creates a TV. He gets that. He's going to say, yeah, I'm just talking about the mathematical system, and I can pin down what the equilibrium value has to be so we know that's how many workers must be hired in equilibrium. But my point is just, I'm stressing in case you guys haven't, that hasn't clicked with you yet, the Keynesians do tend to reason the opposite in terms of causality from how the Austrians do. And that they tend to think, like they'll figure out what the out level of output is first and then go backwards and say, so therefore what does employment have to be? Okay, so anyway, the point is they want to boost Y. They want to go from Y1 to Y2 because the full employment level of output is higher than Y1. So how do they do that? Well, they have to move one or both of these curves. So if the government runs a bigger budget deficit, then the IS curve shifts to the right, and you can see the new intersection point, I2 is higher, and Y2 is higher. All right, so that's obvious in terms of the geometry. But now, in terms of the economics, exactly what's going on. Why is it so? It's enough if I can just explain to you guys why do the Keynesians think running a higher budget deficit, government budget deficit, other things equal, pushes the IS curve to the right. If I can do that, well, then I've answered the question. Because you can see graphically why pushing that curve to the right pushes up interest rates and pushes out output. So, again, you got to just remind yourself, what is the IS curve? Once you remember what it is, then you can see why tweaking one of the things makes you redraw it, and it just so happened to redraw it to the right of the first curve. So the IS curve, let's go to our definitions. It assumes the interest rate is the independent variable, and it traces out the combinations of interest rates and total output that make investment equal to saving. All right, so again, remember the ISLM curves, what they're doing is the two variables are I and Y, interest rates and total output, real output, and then they're going to summarize the equilibrium relationships that you can derive from the Keynesian analysis. And the point is, in equilibrium, they both have to be true simultaneously. And so that's why you're looking at where the curves intersect. So the IS curve, what is that doing? That is showing the locus of points, if you know that term locus, or the collection of points in the plane of I, Y, meaning the combinations of interest rates and real output such that total savings equals total investment, because that has to be true in equilibrium. Let me say that again. You may have thought that the Keynesians believed savings could be higher than investment, and that's not true. The Keynesians think that as an accounting tautology, savings always equals investments. But the trick is they think if people are trying to save too much, what happens is total output collapses to reduce the amount of savings so that it comes back into equality with investment. All right, so that's why. So again, this original IS curve is showing that the various combinations of the interest rate and output that will equate total savings with total investment. So the idea is, oh, if the interest rate were way up here, you would go to that level, and that's what real output would have to be to make interest equal to, or investments equal to savings. If the interest rate were way down here, you go out to the right on this original IS curve and then come down, and that's what total output is. So the question is, why is the IS curve downward sloping? And remember, don't get confused. This is not a standard loanable funds diagram. It's not that, oh, here's the interest rate, and then if the interest rate goes down, people want to borrow more funds, and that's why the curve is downward sloping, because this variable on this lower axis here is output. It's not the quantity of borrowing. Okay, so we got to just think through. So at a lower interest rate, it is true that people want to, the business, you know, given the level of animal spirits, given the amount of, what do you call it, demand for products from businesses and so forth, it is still true that, okay, all that stuff fixed, even in the Keynesian world, the lower the interest rate is, the more businesses will want to borrow and invest. Because remember, that was the whole discussion about the marginal efficiency of capital. That's why Keynes wants to push down the interest rate, because he thinks business people will invest in more machinery and capital goods in general, because they'll run the numbers and look at what the internal rate of return is. And if the internal rate of return for a machine is 6% and the interest rate's 8%, it doesn't make sense to produce that machine. But if the interest rate's 5%, then it does make sense to produce that machine, right? Because you can borrow at 5% and then invest in the production of that machine that internally yields a rate of return of 6%, you know, above its cost of production or whatever you, however you want to classify that. All right, so that's why the lower you push the interest rate, the more investment spending there's going to be. So what happens if, so that kind of makes sense. And so that should give you an idea of, okay, that's why, you know, the interest rate goes down, people invest more and, you know, and that they're spending more, and that with the multiplier and all that, that's consistent with higher level of real output. Now, what, why would, I think I don't want to say this. What if the total average rate of savings goes down? What if the community in general doesn't want to save as much? That pushes the IS curve out to the right. And so what that means is, for a given interest rate now, in order to make savings equal investment, you have to have a higher level of total output. Okay, so make sure you're with me so far. That's what it means to push the IS curve out to the right. It means that for a given interest rate, total output now needs to be higher in order to keep the equality between savings and investment. Because, again, that the IS curve, by definition, is tracing out the combinations of I and Y that keep investments equal to savings. So why would it be the case that if the savings rate goes down, if the propensity to consume goes up, why does that push out the IS curve? Because if all that's changed is the saving rate has gone down, then think of it this way. And, okay, for a given interest rate, holding constant, animal spirits, you know, investment or consumer demand for your products and all that stuff, if now all of a sudden the public wants to save a lower fraction of their income, or what is it, they want to consume a higher fraction of their income, well, that's certainly not going to push down total investment spending. That's going to push it up. Everyone with me so far? So let me just say it again. In the Keynesian framework, the public right now, you know, we're at initial equilibrium. Now all of a sudden the public decides we want to save less of our income and go consume more. So the savings rate goes down. Is that going to make business invest more or less? Now, if you're an Austrian, you're thinking, well, wait a minute. There's less savings going around. Businesses have to invest less. But you're thinking about it in terms of Austrian economics. Don't think of it that way. From the Keynesian point of view, investment is determined by things like the interest rate, animal spirits, and so forth. So if anything, investment spending is going to go up. because we're holding the interest rate constant. We're doing a thought experiment saying, hold the interest rate constant. If investment spend, if people want to save less, what happens? Well, that means they're consuming more. They're spending more on final consumption. So if anything, businesses now are going to be more aggressive and spend more on investment because the demand for their products has gone up. So how is that consistent with equilibrium? We've got the public trying to save a smaller fraction of its income. So S is dropping at the same time that businesses want to invest more. So I is rising. How do we restore equilibrium if you want to hold interest rates constant? Oh, you do it by having total output go up. Because then that's consistent. That will make everything equal. You can have the public saving a lower fraction of its income and still have total savings be higher in absolute terms than it was before if total income is higher. So if the public goes from saving 10% of its income down to saving 5%, if income more than doubles, then the public's absolute amount of total savings goes up. And so that's how it's consistent with savings still being equal in the aggregate total investment. All right, so don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying if the public tries to save more, interest rates won't change. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is to see why a drop in the savings rate pushes the IS curve to the right, what does that mean to say the curve moved to the right? Really, all you're doing is you drew the curve one time, then you changed something and drew the curve again. And it just so happens that the second curve is to the right of the first curve. So when you're trying to think through what does that mean, I'm saying just pick some interest rate, like 8%, and say what does it mean that on the green curve, the first one at 8% corresponded to a low level of output, but now on this lighter blue or whatever the color that is, aqua curve, at 8%, we go way the heck over to the right in order to get on the new IS curve. I'm saying that's happening because the only way in the Keynesian framework you can have total savings being equal to total investment when the public is saving a lower fraction of its income is if income is a heck of a lot higher. And so that's why for a given interest rate, the Y that now falls on the IS curve is way to the right of the original Y that fell on the green curve. Okay, so don't get confused. We're not saying output just doubles automatically. We're just saying in order for it to be consistent with equilibrium, output would have to double. Okay, maybe I'm making this too complicated for you guys, but I'm trying to talk you through it here. Figure out why the curves work, and then you'll see that the interest rate is going to move based on when we change stuff, but that's because it intersects with the LM curve. Okay, so again, changing the IS curve is, moving it around, the interest rate will respond, but the point is it's responding because now it's intersecting the LM curve somewhere else. Okay. And so, for example, you'll see this green curve here, in this particular example. When the green curve shifts to the right and turns into the blue curve, the interest rate does go up. It goes from I1 up to I2. So your intuition is correct that if the public saves a lower fraction of its income, that pushes up interest rates. But what I'm saying is in order for you to keep the causal forces distinct and not be arguing in a circle, you have to first just ask yourself what makes the IS curve move to the new location. And for that, I think it's easiest to just pick an interest rate and hold it constant and just figure out what does it mean that on this new curve for the given interest rate, we move way the heck to the right. It is such a higher level of output. And I'm saying because if you're saving a lower fraction of your income and people want to invest more, the only way it's possible to keep total savings equal to total investment is if total income has gone way up. Because it's got to be the case that a lower fraction of total income now in absolute terms equals a higher level of absolute investment. So clearly, total income had to go way up for that to be true. Okay, so if you get what I just talked about there, how in general a drop in the savings rate pushes the IS curve to the right, well then you can see, all right, if the public in general is not going to do that because it's the middle of a recession, everyone's freaking out, they're saving a lot, how do you lower the average savings rate? Well, the government can be a massive borrower. And so then in terms of the system as a whole, the amount of savings has gone down because now the government is a massive borrower. So the government's counteracting the public's increased desire to save. The government is more than offsetting that. And so that's what Krugman has been saying lately. If you've been reading his stuff, you'll know. He's saying precisely because the private sector has this debt overhang and they're trying to save and pay down their debts, that's why we need the government to now be profligate as all heck, because the government has to overcome the desire to save on the part of the private sector, because right now we need the IS curve to shift to the right. Okay, so let me see now. So is that helped, John, or am I not? I mean, it was worthwhile me going through that anyway, because that's important stuff for you guys to know. Okay, so John, you get that. All right, great. So again, let me just say one more time, to figure out how these curves move and everything, and then just to tell the equilibrium story, it is true that the interest rate is going to change, and it is true that if the government runs bigger deficits, even in the standard ISLM framework, the interest rate could go up from I1 to I2. But the point is, but to understand why the curve moves when there is a drop in the savings rate, I think the best way to think about it is to hold the interest rate fixed. Just like if you say, picture a conventional supply and demand framework for apples. And you say, hey, what's going to happen if the demand for apples goes way up? Well, you guys just know, you draw a new demand curve to the right and you keep the supply curve the same. But what does it mean to draw the demand curve to the right with the economics? Well, what that means is for a given price of apples, people now want to buy a higher quantity of apples. That's what it means to say the demand shifted to the right. So in terms of graphically and in terms of figuring out how do I draw the picture to correspond to the concept of an increased demand for apples, what you're saying is for any given price, the quantity now is bigger than it was before. And so if you go ahead and do that exercise, when you're all done, you look at the picture and you say, oh, it's like I took the first curve and just pushed to the right, even though technically you're not moving curves around, you're just redrawing a curve, and then after the fact, it looks like you moved it. And so so there, in that case with the apples, it's true if the demand for apples goes up, the price of apples is going to change. But in order for you to keep the story straight and figure it out, you first say, suppose the price is constant, what do I mean when I say the demand goes up? And then you say, I mean that for any given price, you just go out further to the right and plot that point. And then, given the supply curve, now the new intersection point is going to occur at a higher price. So prices, of course, the price of apples does go up when demand goes up, but I'm saying to talk about and isolate what does it mean to say demand goes up, conceptually the easiest way to think of that is to say for a given price, what's the quantity? So the same thing here with the IS curve. Yeah, if the savings rate goes down, if the government starts running massive deficits, that is going to put upward pressure on interest rates, but the way to conceptually isolate that and say how do I move the IS curve, or actually how do I plot a new IS curve based on a lower savings rate? Just think of it in terms of fix an interest rate. What did total output have to be originally to equate total savings with total investment? Now, because the public is saving a lower fraction of their income for that given interest rate, what does total output have to be to render total savings equal to total investment. And then that's the new point on the new IS curve. And you just keep doing that for all possible interest rates, and you've plotted your new IS curve. And now, where does that intersect the original LM curve? Up at a higher interest rate. So interest rates do move, but that's not the way you think through the plotting of the new curve. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about the LM curve. Oh, well, John's asking. Why don't I just finish that train of thought, and then I'll catch your other question. So John says, so on the LM side, is liquidity preference the desire to hold cash? Yes. So the LM curve, what is that doing? Again, this is just review. What is this thing? It is summarizing the collection of points where various levels of output. So for the LM curve, they typically think of output as the independent variable. So you're saying, tell me what total output is, and then the LM curve points you to the corresponding nominal interest rate that equates the demand to hold cash with the quantity of cash that's in existence at that moment. And so why is it upward sloping? Well, for a higher level of output, let me think through this for a second. Let me think one move ahead and make sure what I'm going to say is going to work. Higher level output, let's save more money. Oh, right, yeah. So for a higher level of, so other things equal, as output increases, people would want to hold higher and higher cash balances. Right, just because of the transaction demand for money. If your income is higher, you're buying more stuff, right? And so for whatever determines how much cash you want to carry around, the higher your income, the higher that number is going to be. So it might not be one for one, but the point is if you're somebody who makes $50,000 a year and we ask, in general, how much cash do you have at any given time, and you can define it either like as your checking account balance or like the physical paper in your wallet, whatever you want to use, you know, either way works, just be consistent with it. Say, how much cash do you have? Well, if you earn $50,000 a year, it's going to be one number. If you earn $200,000 a year, it's going to be a higher number, right? You're going to tend to carry around more cash on you the higher your income is. So, again, other things equal, as Y goes up, as total output goes up, that means the people in that economy, their total income is higher. So other things equal, they're going to want to carry larger and larger cash balances. But wait a minute, that can't happen. That's physically impossible. For right now, given the stock of money in existence, the public can only hold that much money. So if Y is going up and the public wants to hold more and more money, other things equal, something has to change in order to maintain that equality between the demand to hold cash and the quantity of cash that's in existence. So what the Keynesians say changes is that interest rates have to go up. So that's why the LM curve is upward sloping. It's because as Y goes up, and people, other things equal, would want to be holding more and more cash. They can't hold more cash because there's not more cash to go around. There's only the fixed stockpile. The way to temper that force is for interest rates to go up. So now, in order for that explanation to make sense, you have to realize, wait a minute, why would rising interest rates make people less willing to hold cash? Because in the Keynesian view, the interest rate is the opportunity cost of holding your wealth in the form of cash, as opposed to a less liquid asset. So if you're you're sitting $1,000 in cash, you could just keep sitting on it, and you're going to earn a 0% return. You know, that $1,000 in cash is going to be worth $1,000 next week and next month and next year if you just sit on it. But if you buy a 30-day bond, then what is that asset going to be worth to you in 1 month? It's going to be, it depends on what the interest rate is. So if the 30-day interest rate is 1%, and you take your $1,000 and put it in there, after 1 month, assuming there's no default, you're going to have $1,010. So in that 1 month thing, the opportunity cost of you holding it literally as cash in your wallet is $10. But if the 1 month interest rate is 2%, well, now the cost to you is $20. And if it's 3%, the cost to you is $30, right? So there's that trade-off. So why does anyone ever hold cash? Why doesn't everyone take all of their cash and buy short-term bonds with it? Well, it's the liquidity preference, right? Because when you actually have to go buy something, you need money. You can't go to the grocery store and buy your food with bonds. You have to first turn the bonds into money. So Keynes's point is, you know, if you were certain of the sequence of expenditures you were going to make over the next 50 years of your life, you would hold very little cash at all. You would only hold enough cash, you know, maybe for the current month's expenditures, and everything else you would have invested in bonds that would come due and pay you the cash you needed to then that day go make your purchases, because you could be reaping the interest return. But people in the real world don't do that. People in the real world hold much higher cash balances than what they need to just finance, you know, the next day's purchases. So why do they do that? And Keynes said, oh, it's because of uncertainty. You're not sure actually how much cash you're going to use buying stuff next month. You have a good idea, but you're not sure. And you really don't know how much cash you're going to spend 18 months from now, because that's further in the future, and you just don't know what's going to happen. And so you don't want to have all of your wealth tied up into bonds, even though they're earning interest, because maybe your plans change and you realize, oops, I have to spend more 3 months from now than right now I'm planning on having to spend. So if I put all of my wealth, you know, so if I thought, oh, 3 months from now I'm going to spend $10,000, you know, I have to pay my landlord, I have to buy food, I have to buy gas, I'm going to go to the movies, and you think through all the stuff you're going to do 3 months from now during that month, and you come up with a number, oh, I'm going to spend $10,000. So how am I going to prepare for that, for those expenditures? I'm going to take enough money right now, I'm going to take, you know, $9,950, put it into 3 month bonds that will come due exactly when I need them, and I'll get the $10,000. And so I'll do that instead of taking $10,000 right now and sitting on it. You see how that works? If you do it through bonds, it takes less money in the present because there's the interest return. So in order to set aside enough purchasing power for that $10,000 3 months from now in cash, I need to set aside $10,000. Because that's just going to sit there and not earn interest. But if I'm going to do it through bonds, I don't need to use $10,000 right now. I can use $9,950 or whatever and buy the 3 month bonds, because those will mature into $10,000. Okay, so why don't people do their finances like that? Why are they erring on the side of holding more cash, even though it earns a 0% interest rate? Because what happens if next month I get in a car accident or something, and my income goes down because I can't go to work, or I have more, you know, high medical bills, my insurance is covered. So what if next month I actually need to spend more than my original plan thought I would have to spend? And so I have to totally rearrange my budget, and now I'm going to spend more next month, and I'm going to spend less 3 months from now. So I'm shifting some of those expenditures from distant future into the present because I have to juggle things around. So what do I have? I don't have the cash. I can't afford to spend more next month because I tied up all my money in bonds. So what do I have to do? I have to sell those bonds now and turn them into cash. I can't just wait for the contractual interest payments and principal return. I need to go into the market, into the bond market right now and raise cash by selling them off. And so if interest rates have gone up since I first did all this stuff, I'm going to get less for my bond than possibly what I put into it. Well, yeah, for sure I'll get less. Well, it depends on how close it is to maturity. Never mind. If it's a long-term bond. You know, if I put my money into a 10-year bond and 1 month passes and interest rates went up by 2 percentage points and then I try to sell the bond, I'm going to get less than I put into it. Right? Because if interest rates go up, bond prices go down. So that's what Keynes has in mind. So he's saying the reason people there's a trade-off. The more money, the more of your wealth you're holding in actual cash, the better prepared you are to deal with unexpected changes in your desire to spend and buy stuff. Or it could be investment spending, too. It's not just consumption. If you all of a sudden see a lucrative investment opportunity and you want to buy a piece of real estate to speculate on because you come across a piece of real estate that you think, whoa, this is selling for $100,000 right now. I bet you next year this is going to be worth $150,000. I need to come up with $100,000 cash pronto. If you've got all your money tied up in bonds, you might have to take a big hit on turning them into cash so you can buy the real estate. Whereas if you had a bunch of cash sitting around, you wouldn't have to take the hit. The cash would be worth, you know, if you had $100,000 in $100 bills, there's no question of, well, how much money is that worth? It's worth $100,000 by definition. That's what money is. Okay, so that's what Keynes is talking about when he says cash is, by definition, the most liquid of assets. And so if you have liquidity preference, that's why he's talking about that's the demand to hold money. So that's the trade-off. The higher the interest rate, the more you're giving up by keeping your wealth in the form of cash. So that's why now, other things equal, if the public wants to hold more cash than is available, the way you tamp down that demand is you have the interest rate go up because now the penalty for holding cash is higher. And so even though, so back to the LM curve now, so if Y goes up, that makes people want to hold larger cash balances to finance more purchases and so forth. But they can't do that. That's physically impossible because the money stock is whatever it is. And so that's why the interest rate goes up to counteract that. So that's how you draw an upward sloping LM curve. All right, so now the Keynes are saying in equilibrium, both things have to be true at the same time. Total savings has to equal total investments. So we have to be somewhere on the IS curve. And the total demand to hold money has to be equal to the stock of money. So we have to be on the LM curve. Okay, thanks, buddy. And so that's why in equilibrium, then, you look at where those two curves intersect, because that is the unique point, the unique interest rate and level of output that makes both of those things true at the same time. Okay. So in response to what I was saying before, Scott says, so if you build it, they will buy, as opposed to if I want something else, I will sell. Right, Scott, that the Keynesians, you think Scott's referring to my comment that the Keynesians sort of reason in the opposite way from how an Austrian would, that, yeah, they kind of think if there's the demand for a product, the producer will make it, and therefore somebody must have been hired. And so it goes from, you know, demand creating employment. as opposed to the more classical view and Austrian view of we have limited resources, workers and other resources will get channeled in a certain line, they'll produce stuff, and then you know, you'll get paid in accordance with your marginal product. And so your ability to produce will determine what your purchasing power is, and then you as a consumer go to the store and buy the stuff that you made. And so that, you know, it's a very crude way of putting it, but if you had to boil it down to those things, yeah, I would say the classical economists and the Austrians think that supply creates demand, whereas the Keynesians think demand creates supply. So again, strictly speaking, both of those statements are false. But in terms of having a pithy summary of how they think the economy works, I think that's the way you would have to summarize it. And of course, the Austrians think the hard part with an economy is producing stuff. The hard part is getting workers to get up in the morning and go into the factory and sit there for 8 hours doing something that's monotonous. It's easy to consume. Once the products are made, it's not an issue to convince people, oh, come on, don't you want to go eat that pizza? Or don't you want to watch the plasma screen TV? The hard part in economics is producing stuff because of scarcity. The hard part is not to enjoy consumption, whereas the Keynesians write as if, you know, our economic woes are due to the fact that consumers just, they're not willing to go to the mall and buy stuff. And the Austrians, of course, think it's the other way around. No, the problem is the production structure gets screwed up, and then we're not able to physically crank out as much stuff because the capital structure is out of whack due to the malinvestments made during the boom. Okay, so let me go back to the questions here. Benjamin says, since the general theory position requires government manipulation of the real value of money and the interest rate, which is arguably stealing value from savers and retirees and arguably immoral, did anyone ever openly challenge Keynes on this point? Was Keynes preaching this to the British government prior to publishing his masterpiece? I think if there was no Keynes in economics and Bernie Madoff developed it, there might be a different reaction today than the one that Lord Keynes received. Well, for sure, Keynes was preaching that before the general theory came out. I mean, remember, hang on, I'm going to move my computer. Okay. Remember that, sorry, I'm going to get this straight. Keynes was, he was part of that, the letter to the Times, and that was what, 1932, and the general theory came out in 36. All right, so Keynes certainly believed in a lot of this stuff years before the general theory came out and was actively promoting it. Did anyone ever openly challenge Keynes? I mean, certainly Hayek did. Now, if you mean did anyone ever just come out and say, hey, you're stealing – Hayek wouldn't have used such inflammatory language. So Hayek would have challenged Keynes in terms of the technical economics and saying, pragmatically, this is what's going to happen if we pursue your policies. I'm trying to think. I mean, you certainly had firebrands like John T. Flynn and other critics of the New Deal in the 1930s calling Roosevelt a fascist and, you know, using emotional value-laden rhetoric. And so I'm sure those guys must have criticized Keynesian economics. But, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of, you know, what they would have said. And I'm trying to remember, like, what Henry Hazlitt would have said at that stage. Obviously, later on, Hazlitt would have been real forthcoming and not pulling punches, but I don't know what those guys said what, you know, in terms of their public positions in the 30s, like if, how much they had to temper their rhetoric and so forth. Mises was pretty radical. I mean, he would talk about his opponents believing in the Santa Claus principle and stuff like that. I mean, so that's kind of, you know, ridicule and heaping scorn on people. So I don't know off the top of my head. I can't think of something Mises wrote in 1938 criticizing Keynes. And so that's true. I mean, he probably did do that. I don't know off the top of my head. But I think you're right if what you're getting at, Benjamin, is that Keynes got a free pass and he was considered this grand public intellectual and nobody just said, what are you talking about? That's theft. You're right. That probably would have been ruled as impolite. Okay, we got about 10 more minutes, I think. To the kids. Okay. Benjamin says, it has been said that Japan cannot be compared to the United States as far as hyperinflation and debt to GDP goes because for various reasons. One, Japan sells its debt to its own people. Two, they do not have the world's reserve currency like the U.S. does. Three, Japan is a creditor nation. Four, Japan has no military budget compared to the U.S. And five, hyperinflation is a currency event. Bernanke prints $1 too many. The bond vigilantes revolt. Bernanke now has no choice but to push the accelerator to the floor and the printing press to stop scarring interest rates and poof, hyperinflation. Do you think any of these points is valid? So just to give the context again there, the issue is a lot of Austrians are worried about what Bernanke has been doing with the monetary base and, of course, what the Treasury is doing in terms of running massive deficits. And among the things we say is that, you know, this is in danger of wrecking the dollar and we're going to get price inflation at home. And so the typical response is to say, what are you talking about? That's what they did in Japan, and that hasn't, you know, Japan's had deflation, price deflation in various stretches, and the yen continues to strengthen. So what are you talking about? You guys are crazy. And so now Benjamin is saying that some people have offered reasons for drawing a distinction between what happened with the Japanese and what's going to happen in the United States. So of the stuff you mentioned there, Benjamin, one that I think is valid is the world reserve currency thing, that a lot of people around the world hold U.S. dollars. And so if the genie ever did get out of the bottle, it would be a lot more catastrophic than if people lost faith in the yen. That in other words, if the Bank of Japan prints too many yen, largely speaking, that would just mean, okay, their prices in Japan would start going up too fast and then they would have to reverse course. But if Bernanke steps over the line and everyone just decides, you know what, he's just going to keep inflating, this is the dollar's dead, and they all dump the dollar, it's not like, oops, we printed 2% too much and now prices are rising, so we got to ease off a little bit and then let, you know, prices fall back down. No, there would be a flood of dollars coming back to the United States, and so prices might go up 30% in a year unless Bernanke does incredibly drastic things. So I think that's what you're getting at with some of your points there. And so, yeah, I think that's true, and that's an important difference. Now, you could say that doesn't really answer the objection, that we're just showing there that the danger of the U.S. inflating too much is greater than the danger of Japan inflating too much, but it still doesn't show, you know, what we just talked about. That doesn't explain why Japan didn't see large price inflation. Because if you think about it, if what we were trying to explain is that Japan did this stuff and the price level in Japan went up, but Bernanke's doing this stuff and U.S. prices haven't gone up, then it would make total sense to say, oh, well, the dollar is the world's reserve currency, so Bernanke has a much bigger, wider margin of error. He can print a lot more, and it gets sopped up by people around the world rather than just pushing up U.S. prices, whereas in Japan, they don't have nearly the global market for the yen as the U.S. does for the dollar, and so that's why if the Bank of Japan inflates, it more quickly translates into rising prices domestically. But that's not what we're trying to explain. We're trying to explain how come when the Bank of Japan boosted its monetary base by 30% or whatever the number was in 1 year, why didn't Japanese CPI rise by 8% or something, which is what a very mechanical quantity theory of money explanation would say. And we didn't see that. So that it's not the full story, but I do think it's important to point out that, yeah, the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, and so that means the risk of inflating too much is greater for the U.S. than it is for the Bank of Japan. But by itself, that observation doesn't solve the mystery. The stuff about Japan being a creditor nation, I'm going to say hi. I'm not sure. I don't know. I have to think through that. I've never been convinced by that. I mean, it's certainly true that that's an important reason, or that's a relevant fact to consider when trying to evaluate the long-run health of the two economies. That I think if the Japanese government just, you know, cut tax rates, cut its spending, and the Bank of Japan's, you know, just let its balance sheet shrink back down to normal levels, I think Japan would be poised for a faster recovery and healthier long-term growth than the U.S. precisely because the Japanese people tend to save a lot more. So that's certainly true. But in terms of explaining the specific puzzle of if we as Austrians think that creating a bunch of money and having massive budget deficits would tend to hurt your currency and push up price inflation, why isn't that happening in Japan? To say, oh, well, they have a high savings rate, I'm not sure that that does. I mean, because it's not that their savings rate increased, as far as I know. It, maybe it did. I mean, I haven't checked the numbers, but my point is just if the Japanese people were very frugal and saved a lot before the lost decade, when they had, you know, when the Bank of Japan wasn't creating a bunch of money and the government wasn't running ridiculous deficits, and then now the government is running huge deficits and the Bank of Japan's printing a bunch of new yen, the, you know, whatever the old equilibrium was, the new equilibrium prices should be going higher and the yen should be falling against other currencies and interest rates in Japan should be going up, holding everything else constant. So that's what I mean. I've just never seen someone, to my satisfaction, spell out why a high savings rate, unless you're saying the savings rate went up in response to all these things, but just to say all along they've had a high savings rate, it's not clicking with me as to why that would mean, oh, so the Bank of Japan can make the monetary base go up 30% and you'll still have price deflation. All right, why don't we move on here. Scott says, in the Keynesian framework, are the IS and LM curves always straight lines? In other words, it's always purely theoretical? If I'm understanding you, yes, because if you were going to actually try to do like an empirical project and like forecast what you thought GDP figures were going to be over the next four quarters and you were relying on a Keynesian model, you wouldn't be drawing curves. You would, you know, you'd have more specific data and things like that and then like actual formulas. So if that's what you're asking, then right. I mean, the ISLM framework is just for almost pedagogical purposes, almost just like to clarify issues, to think about things in big picture terms. If you're actually going to try to do real world projections, you're not going to be literally drawing the curves out and seeing where they intersect. I mean, you're going to be doing it with formulas and stuff. However, though, in the present crisis, the way a lot of Keynesians right now are modeling it is they're saying that there's a horizontal LM curve. They're saying, oh, right now Bernanke's going to just pick whatever the interest rate is and then do whatever open market operations he needs to do to maintain that. So the way you would handle that graphically is to draw a horizontal LM curve showing the interest rate is just whatever it is for all levels of output. So, I mean, there it's still a straight line, but I'm just pointing out, depending on the analysis, the curves might not look like typical supply and demand curves. They might make them really shallow or really steep. Okay. And I think we just got time for one more question. Let me just see here. Okay, just two quick ones. So Scott says, based on a Wall Street Journal article by David Wessel, is deflation just a word used to demonize a fall in prices to a market clearing rate? I haven't read the. I think you may have linked to it. Yeah, I see what you're saying. You're referring to a Wall Street Journal article that quotes Krugman and Scott Sumner on the liquidity trap. And that's the thing. People think the Wall Street Journal is this bastion of free market economics, and it's not, at least certainly not from an Austrian point of view. The Wall Street Journal is actually Keynesian in the sense of they believe in that aggregate demand is the way you analyze things, and it's just they think the way to boost spending is to give tax cuts to people, and then they'll go out and spend more. I mean, I think that's a fair summary, as opposed to the government doing it. But it's not that they're opposed to the notion that aggregate spending is the thing that needs to change to fix the economy. And yet, the people in the Wall Street Journal are afraid of deflation just as much as Paul Krugman is. So when they say deflation, they mean falling prices, and they mean, and yeah, they're worried there's going to be a downward spiral, and then if prices fall, people spend less because they're waiting for bargains. You know, why buy the washing machine today when it's going to be cheaper 6 months from now? And then that just exacerbates the problem. So again, the two go hand in hand. The reason they're worried about deflation is because they think spending is what's important. And so if prices are falling, they're worried people aren't going to spend enough. Okay, and then the last question is John Ware says, asks my opinion of Henry Hazlitt's book on the general theory. So he's referring to Henry Hazlitt had this big, thick book called The Failure of the, quote, New Economics, and he just goes through in painstaking detail critiquing it at times almost line by line going through the general theory from start to finish. So in general, I love the fact that he did that. I mean, some people have criticized Hazlitt and said, oh, you know, that's too long. You should have just done a shorter thing, like just hitting broad themes. And I don't think so. I mean, I think somebody had to do that. Now, as far as do I think he did a good job, I have to confess I haven't read the book in years. I mean, I may have been an undergrad when I read that thing. And so, first of all, I can barely remember it. Second of all, whatever my opinion of it was as an undergrad student doesn't mean as much because I wasn't as good an economist then as I am now, or at least I hope I'm better now, right? So it's hard for me to say. In other words, I don't. If I were to read it right now with fresh eyes, I don't know what my opinion would be because I can barely remember in the first place. And even if I thought it was awesome back then, maybe now I would think, oh, he was. Because I didn't know the Kane Dean position back then as well as I do now. So back then, I might have thought that Hazlitt was hitting it out of the park on certain points, and maybe now I would realize, oh, no, he's not getting what the Kane Dean position is. And so that's the kind of thing I have no idea of knowing unless I went and reread it. Having said all that, I do think that Hazlitt did a good job, as my memory serves me. For sure, I think he hit the big picture themes about the Kane Deans are completely ignoring capital structure. They're ignoring the issue of cause and effect. They're looking at aggregate statistical relationships and thinking that they're going to hold up. And I think that that's wrong. In other words, if we look over the last 10 years and look at the data, consumption spending and investment spending have always been, this proportion of total output. And so if we just increase investment spending, that will boost output by such and such, that's a fallacy. That's assuming that investment spending is always going to be the same fraction of output, and that might not be true. Okay, so I think on those kinds of things, Hazlitt's great. The one thing I do remember where I think he was off is when he was talking about the area of what's called the own rate of interest. And Keynes was talking about, looking at wheat prices, spot versus the future price, and then calculating the ratio between present bushels of wheat and future bushels of wheat and that sort of process. And the reason I thought it was ironic is what Hazlitt says criticizing Keynes there, I think, could equally be used against the pure time preference theory of interest. So it's not even that I have a problem with what Hazlitt was saying. It's just in my dissertation, I used that section to show Austrians, look at, I'm not the only one who's had these concerns. Henry Hazlitt, when he was attacking Keynes, said stuff that if we took those weapons and turned them against Mises, would hurt the Austrian theory of interest, or at least that was my claim. Maybe I'm sure Joe Salerno wouldn't agree with me. But anyway, that's the one thing I can remember is I thought it was ironic that Hazlitt was, in one part of the book, using an argument to knock down Keynes that could just as well have applied against Hazlitt later on in the book, talking about the right way to think about interest. But, that's a minor little thing. That stands fresh in my memory since I used it in my dissertation. So certainly, if what you're asking me is, do you have my blessing to go read Hazlitt? Of course you do. You read everything. I don't think there's a. I don't think people should, not read a certain book because they're going to say, oh no, if I read that, that's going to put me on the wrong path. You need to read whatever and then decide for yourself what the best thing is. But I can't tell you off the top of my head whether I think Hazlitt did a good job setting up the Keynesian system and then knocking it down, because it's just been so long since I read it. All right, guys, well, I think we're over time then, right? Let me just make sure. Yeah, right, so I started at 11th. Okay, so, yep, we're over time, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in.